Your option, our task. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
A little more than a year and 3 months have passed since the beginning of the war in Ukraine, but today it is very clear that the consequences of this conflict have not only affected the countries of the region, but also have affected or will affect many countries in the world. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. Common Dreams website has covered this story and tells us more. An American academic and political analyst has said that Washington's insistence on NATO enlargement to Ukraine has made the country a victim of unachievable U.S. military aspirations. In an article titled "The War in Ukraine Was Provoked and Why That Matters to Achieve Peace," Professor Jeffrey Sachs wrote that the Ukraine war was provoked by the United States and President Biden played a personal role in it. Jeffrey Sachs wrote in the article, "The Biden administration has repeatedly and falsely claimed that the Ukraine war started with an unprovoked attack by Russia on Ukraine on 24th of February 2022. Professor Jeffrey Sachs added, "In fact, the war was provoked by the United States in ways that leading U.S. diplomats anticipated for decades in the lead-up to the war, meaning that the war could have been avoided and should now be stopped through negotiations." Professor Jeffrey Sachs, who is a university professor and director of the Center for Sustainable Development at Columbia University in New York, commented that relentless U.S. push to expand NATO was one of two main U.S. provocations that precipitated the war in Ukraine. He added, "The first was the U.S. intention to expand NATO to Ukraine and to Georgia in order to surround Russia in the Black Sea region by NATO countries, Ukraine, Romania, Bulgaria, Turkey and Georgia in counterclockwise order." He added, "The second reason was the US role in installing a Russophobic regime in Ukraine by the violent overthrow of Ukraine's former president Viktor Yanukovych in February of 2014. The Columbia University professor explained that the shooting war in Ukraine began with President Viktor Yanukovych's overthrow 9 years ago, not in February of 2022, as the US government, NATO and the G7 leaders have us believe. Professor Jeffrey Sachs wrote, "Biden and his foreign policy team refused to discuss these roots of the war in Ukraine because it would expose that Biden played a personal role in the war as a participant in the overthrow of former Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych." The academic added that before that, Biden was a staunch backer of the military-industrial complex and very early advocate of NATO enlargement, asking, "Who exactly are Biden's sponsors?" Russia began a special operation in Ukraine on 24th of February 2022 as part of a national security measure against the persisting eastern advance of the US-led NATO military alliance. Moscow also said the special operation was aimed at defending the pro-Russia population in eastern Ukrainian regions, particularly Luhansk and Donetsk, against persecution by Kiev and also to denazify Ukraine. Professor Jeffrey Sachs wrote, "The key to peace in Ukraine is through negotiations based on Ukraine's neutrality and NATO non-enlargement." He added, "The Biden administration's insistence on NATO enlargement to Ukraine has made Ukraine a victim of misconceived and unachievable U.S. military aspirations. It's time for the provocations to stop and for negotiations to restore peace to Ukraine. The website of Caribbean News Global has also covered the same story. Former U.S. Congressman Ron Paul has said that President Joe Biden's Ukraine debacle would go down as one of the greatest foreign policy disasters in U.S. history. In an article published recently, Ron Paul, a three-time presidential candidate, slammed the Biden administration's policy on Project Ukraine, for which, he said, Congress has already authorized $100 billion. Ron Paul wrote, "The Biden administration's profligate domestic spending is a battleground for Republican lawmakers. However, when it comes to endless spending on Project Ukraine, with a few exceptions, the two parties are in lockstep." Ron Paul added, "One thing is for sure, we can count on Congress to throw good money after bad." Ron Paul pointed out, "The military-industrial complex and the think tanks pushing war and the mainstream media glorifying war all got paid well." He wrote that hundreds of thousands of people have been killed on both sides, the Russian and American sides, in implementing the long-standing U.S. plan for regime change in Russia. Ron Paul noted, "With Russian control established in the strategic city of Bakhmut over the weekend, the neoconservative Ukraine project, like all neoconservative foreign policy projects before it, looks to be progressing rapidly towards failure." Ron Paul added, "But that won't stop the Biden administration from attempting to extort more money from an America already teetering on the brink of economic collapse." Ron Paul said, "Mainstream U.S. media is in a panic over the fact that the $48 billion appropriated for Ukraine by the Biden administration, only $6 billion remains." He wrote, "That won't be enough to sustain Project Ukraine for more than a few weeks." The veteran U.S. politician and commentator said, "The tide of U.S. public opinion turning overwhelmingly against throwing more money down the corrupt black hole called Ukraine." Ron Paul predicted, "With President Biden clearly flailing and with a surprisingly strong primary challenge of Robert Kennedy Jr., we should look for lawmakers to begin abandoning Project Ukraine in droves." The website of Press TV has also covered the same story. New York-based journalist and political commentator Don DeBar has said it would also raise the fundamental question, which is this: who exactly are Biden's sponsors? Don DeBar asked, "Who are the people who shepherded him to the pinnacle of the U.S. government, despite the fact that he has never had a national constituency of support?" Don DeBar further asked, "Who placed him in the Senate in 1973 and helped him find his way to the various committees that allowed him to help bring us to this point of war with Russia, following the most aggressive foreign policy towards Russia and China and any other targets of U.S. corporate imperialists?" Don DeBar also said that the developing alliance between Germany and Ukraine is beginning to resemble World War II axis of alliance at a time that the world is dangerously close to a global conflagration. Don DeBar said recently that a global war will not end well for all the players involved: the United States, Britain, Ukraine, Germany, and others. Don DeBar said, "Today's axis would replace Italy, which is, it should be noted, a willing ally also in the war against Russia, with Ukraine. Both of the other members of the original alliance, Germany and Japan, are under U.S. military occupation and political control." Don DeBar noted, "The historical model was an attempt to construct a global order to compete with the Euro-American global colonial structure. In other words, the old Roman Empire and Holy Roman Empire seeking to take control of the resources of the old Russian Empire in an alliance with Japan that was engaged in an attempt to conquer China. He added, "This time it is a relitigation of the Second World War, but with the United States using the Axis, along with parts of the former USSR, as proxies against the remainder of the Soviet Union." Dunderbar warned, "Since Russia disputes Germany's claimed title to its lands, and since Russia has both the military wherewithal to blow Germany and Europe and the United States to hell, as well as a policy that allows this in the event of an existential threat to the state, such as Germany and the United States and Britain, al, now present, we are perilously close to a global conflagration that can only end very badly for all those involved."
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
A new report has shed light on the covert military operations of the UK's army around the world. The report by The Guardian says Britain's special forces have carried out secret operations in 19 countries over the past 12 years. Countries where British forces involved in included Nigeria, the Philippines, and Russia, as well as in Syria, Ukraine, and most recently Sudan. 11 out of the 19 countries where UK special forces operated secretly were Muslim nations. The elite military units operate in secret without ministers publicly confirming their activities. But a research group, Action on Armed Violence, has compiled a list of their activities since the year 2011, based on media leaks. It says the members of the Special Air Force, Special Boat Service, and Special Reconnaissance Regiment were repeatedly deployed by the Prime Minister and Defense Secretary to conduct high-risk missions, typically where the UK is not at war. Special forces were particularly active in Syria. They reportedly entered the country in 2012 to help anti-Damascus groups fight against President Bashar al-Assad. Reports say that they were also sent to Syria in 2013 to identify military targets in advance of a bombing campaign which was to be conducted by the UK. That bombing campaign was vetoed by members of the parliament.
Senior defense sources have told Newsnight that Britain did, in fact, have a secret plan for intervening in Syria. It was the brainchild of General David Richards, Britain's most senior officer, who told Downing Street there were only two ways of ending the bloodshed quickly. The first was to let Assad win. The second was to defeat him. To defeat him, he recommended training and equipping a substantial army of Syrian rebels.
In Ukraine, the Pentagon documents leaked earlier this year showed that 50 members of UK special forces were in the former Soviet Republic, alongside Kiev forces fighting against Russia. By contrast, the numbers from the US and France were listed as 14 and 15, respectively.
The United Kingdom has unlocked a number of packages in the last year. We're going further. Beginning of this week, I announced to Parliament that we will send a squadron of Challenger 2 main battle tanks to Ukraine. We will send at least three batteries of AS-90 155 long-range deep-fire artillery. We will send a number of armoured vehicles, including the, I think it's the Bulldog, which is a variant of the old 432 armoured personnel carrier, thousands of rounds of ammunition. And today I can say we're also going to send another 600 Brimstone missiles into theatre, which will be incredibly important in helping Ukraine dominate the battlefield.
The report further said the deployments depict a lack of insight by Parliament. While MPs have to vote for a war, special forces can be deployed without Commons approval, and their actions are not subject to investigation by any parliamentary committee. Major military acts of war conducted by UK special forces must be approved by the British Parliament. However, small-scale special forces operations can be carried out without MPs' permission and are not subject to committee investigations. The revelation comes at the heels of earlier reports that special British forces killed innocent civilians in Afghanistan. In March this year, a public inquiry began into allegations that the SAS were responsible for 54 summary killings in Afghanistan in 2010 and 2011, typically on night raids. Men were separated from their families and reportedly shot dead after being said to have produced a weapon.
Quite frankly now, the infantry regiments are doing exactly what they're paid for, certainly since the invasion of Iraq and obviously the operations now in Afghanistan. So therefore, a lot of soldiers are looking at their prospects of going to the Special Air Service for action to get involved in operations. And I say, you know what? I'm doing it already.
Senior military officers have been accused of bearing evidence that British troops were executing detainees in Afghanistan. Apart from Afghanistan, Britain followed Washington's lead against Iraq in 2003. The aggression killed thousands of Iraqis. Meanwhile, the UK policy, detailed, has mandated the military to increase its secret operations in other countries to protect Britain's interests across the globe. The doctrine requires a shift in focus for the future in order to counter Russia and China.
Britain's former Prime Minister has made a controversial trip to the US state of Texas to shore up support for Ukraine. The Center for European Policy Analysis, or the CEPA, a pro-Ukrainian think tank based in Washington, decided to enlist Johnson to push Republicans to support Ukraine. Pro-Ukraine think tankers brought Johnson to a private lunch in Dallas, Texas, to meet two dozen of the state's leading conservative figures, including politicians, donors, and captains of the industry. Johnson's Dallas trip included a visit with former President George W. Bush, in which the two talked about the war in Ukraine. The former UK Prime Minister flew to Texas as a growing number of conservative lawmakers, candidates, and activists have started to question the size of the US support package for Ukraine. Johnson has been enlisted because he is said to have been very much seen as the architect of the Western policy on Ukraine. Johnson was a staunch backer of the West proxy war with Russia during his time in office. He also played a crucial role in ditching peace talks that was held in the early days of the conflict. In April 2022, then Prime Minister Johnson traveled to Kiev and urged Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky to stop negotiating with Russian President Vladimir Putin. Johnson's visit to the US comes amid the backdrop of rising tensions between Russia and Ukraine's Western supporters. Russia has warned that supplying more destructive and advanced weapons by the US and its allies to Ukraine increases the probability of a nuclear apocalypse. Russia's former president Dmitry Medvedev, who is currently serving as deputy chairman of the Russian Security Council, has said that the more weapons are supplied, the more dangerous the world will be. Earlier this month, the United Kingdom announced during a summit of European leaders that it was working with the Netherlands to build a so-called international jet coalition to help Ukraine obtain F-16 fighter jets from its mostly Western allies.
So apparently they believe that a nuclear conflict or a nuclear apocalypse is impossible because it is never possible. They are wrong. And at some point, events can go completely according to an unpredictable scenario, and the responsibility will lie entirely with the North Atlantic Alliance.
Medvedev's warning came days after American President Joe Biden told fellow G7 leaders in Japan that he supported a joint effort with allies to train Ukrainian pilots on F-16 fighter jets. The U.S. has so far committed $48 billion U.S. dollars in military aid and other assistance to Ukraine since the beginning of the war. Washington is the biggest supplier of weaponry to the Ukrainian military. Meanwhile, Russia says it conducted an operation in the border city of Belgorod after Ukraine-based militants staged a sabotage raid there. Russia has said more than 70 attackers were killed in its operation to repel cross-border raiders who entered the country's Belgorod region.
On May 22nd, a unit of the Ukrainian Nationalist Formation invaded the territory of the Russian Federation in the area of the international checkpoint in the Belgorod region. In the course of the counter-terrorist operation, the Nationalist Formations were blocked and defeated by airstrikes, artillery fire, and the active actions of the Western military district units covering the state border. The remaining Nationalists were driven back to the territory of Ukraine, where they were completely eliminated. More than 70 Ukrainian terrorists were eliminated, as well as machinery and armored vehicles.
Russia says the cross-border sabotage was aimed to divert attention away from Bakhmut and minimize Ukraine's losses in the eastern city, which Russian troops claim to have fully captured. The battle over the city has been described as the heaviest to take place between the Russian and Ukrainian forces since last February.
Papua New Guinea has signed a defense and maritime cooperation agreement with the U.S. during the U.S. Pacific Islands Forum in Port Moresby. The agreement was signed by Defense Minister Win Bakridaki and U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken, who flew into the country early on Monday in the place of U.S. President Joe Biden. In a meeting with PNG Prime Minister James Morape during the signing ceremony, Blinken said the United States would deepen its partnership across the board with the country.
The Defense Cooperation Agreement, drafted by Papua New Guinea and the United States as equal and sovereign partners, will enhance the PNG's defense forces' capabilities to deliver humanitarian assistance and disaster relief, including through providing medical care and temporary shelter to those who are affected by crises.
Morape, for his part, hailed the deal as a mutually beneficial agreement.
Both sides have agreed that the agreement that we're signing today is doesn't offend Papua New Guinea law, doesn't offend USA law, is mutually beneficial, especially and for me in the context of Papua New Guinea. It secures our national interest to grow into becoming a robust economy in this part of the world as we live today and going forward.
PNG's Prime Minister James Morape said that to implement the deal, there would be an increased presence of U.S. military personnel and contractors over the next 2 years. However, he insisted that the Americans will not establish a U.S. military base on the island. Morape also denied reports that U.S. staff would have legal immunity and said no amendments would be made to the constitution or laws of the country. That's after a leaked draft document suggested Port Moresby has given U.S. personnel and contractors legal immunity, allowing aircrafts, vehicles, and vessels operated by or on behalf of the U.S. to move freely within its territory and territorial waters, and exemptions for U.S. staff from all migration requirements. The U.S. State Department announced the new pact covers security, defense, and maritime surveillance and would provide $45 million to help improve bilateral cooperation, including protective equipment for the Papua New Guinea Defense Force. PNG, with a population of nearly 10 million people, is the most populous Pacific Island nation, located just north of Australia. The region has witnessed increasing militarization in past years, raising concerns among civil society groups. They accuse Morape of setting the stage for future hostilities between the U.S. and China. PNG's former Prime Minister Peter O'Neill accused his successor of placing the country at the epicenter of a military storm between China and the U.S. by agreeing to enter into defense agreements with both superpowers without consultation with people. Also, opposition leader Joseph Lelang
from the People's National Congress said last week we should not be blinded by the dollar sign or be coerced into signing deals that may be detrimental to us in the long run. He said the foreign policy of Papua New Guinea is friends to all and enemies to none. In the midst of growing rivalry between Washington and Beijing in the Pacific region, China has warned against geopolitical games in the South Pacific after the U.S. signed a security agreement with Papua New Guinea.
What we must be vigilant about is the use of cooperation as a pretext for engaging in geopolitical games, and we believe no cooperation should target third parties.
The foreign ministry spokesperson, however, stressed that China has no objection to normal exchanges and equal, mutually beneficial cooperation with Pacific Island nations, including Papua New Guinea. She said any negotiation and cooperation agreement should benefit regional peace, development, and stability. The Pacific nations manage around 20% of the world's oceans. These hugely important maritime routes were used in World War II to transport supplies to Australia and New Zealand. Western interests in the Pacific waned after the war, but Chinese investments in the region have grown. Beijing has worked to strengthen ties with several island nations over the last decade, sending aid and investing in schools, roads, and bridges. However, in recent years, the U.S. has been expanding its military presence in the Pacific as part of its strategic shift to East Asia, where it seeks to contain the growing power of China.
Mission accomplished. Iranian Navy's 86th flotilla has wrapped up its 8-month voyage and returned home. The flotilla, comprised of domestically manufactured Dena destroyer and Macron forward base ship, arrived at the southern port city of Bandar Abbas on Saturday. The naval fleet set sail on a mission around the world from Bandar Abbas in September 2022. The flotilla stopped at the port of Mumbai, India, and then docked in the Indonesian capital, Jakarta, after passing through the Bay of Bengal and the Strait of Malacca. The fleet continued its journey towards the Java Sea and passed through the Strait of Makassar, arriving in the vast Pacific Ocean for the first time in the history of Iran's military seafaring. Crossing the Pacific Ocean, the fleet moved toward the Strait of Magellan in the south of the Americas and entered the South Atlantic Ocean. The naval squadron also passed the coasts of Chile, Argentina, Uruguay, and finally anchoring in the port of Rio de Janeiro in Brazil. The flotilla then crossed the Atlantic Ocean and anchored in the city of Cape Town, South Africa. It then berthed in the coasts of Oman and finally sailed into the Iranian territorial waters. An official ceremony was held in Bandar Abbas to welcome the arrival of the naval fleet. Addressing the official homecoming ceremony of the flotilla, the chief of staff of the Iranian Armed Forces said the arrival of the 86th Naval Flotilla is a source of pride for the Iranian nation and a landmark accomplishment in the history of the country's naval missions. Major General Mohammad Hossein Bagheri said the flotilla concluded its historic voyage on the high seas to mark what he called an outstanding achievement despite Western-led sanctions against the Islamic Republic. General Bagheri said maritime prowess is among the most important factors of Iran's military might. He added, "We do not lack anything to achieve such an ideal and are gifted with homegrown industries for that purpose." He noted that the Iranian courageous commanders and marines undertake naval missions valiantly and fearlessly. The arrival of the naval fleet to Bandar Abbas comes as the unprecedented move of the Iranian Navy in carrying out such difficult missions ushers in a new era for the Iranian armed forces. As Major General Bagheri put it, the 86th Flotilla of the Navy fulfilled a historic mission. Even major countries in the world do not have the courage to undertake such a task. What makes the round-the-world mission significant, though, is the way Western countries, namely the United States, reacted to it. In February, the U.S. Treasury sanctioned the two ships while they were on the international voyage. According to Iranian officials, the U.S. has also failed to prevent the Iranian naval flotilla from sailing through the Panama Canal, an 82-kilometer waterway in Panama that connects the Atlantic Pacific Oceans. Iran's Navy commander, Rear Admiral Shahram Irani, has said, quote, "The global arrogance tried to block the Iranian flotilla's mission through threats and sanctions, but the successful voyage marked another slap in their faces." The Navy commander also said that France claimed that the Iranian ships had entered its waters, but they changed course when they were reminded of their own shipping rules and regulations. All those reactions highlight Iran's naval prowess in international waters. In recent years, naval forces of the Islamic Republic have enhanced their presence throughout global waters to protect shipping routes and provide security for merchant vessels and tankers. The Iranian Navy has also regularly carried out patrols in the Gulf of Aden and the Indian Ocean to fight piracy in an effort to secure vessels commuting in international waters. Not to mention that numerous attacks on Iranian or foreign vessels have been thwarted by the Iranian Navy in recent years. All in all, the unprecedented voyage by the 86th Flotilla not only has shown Iran's maritime capabilities, but drove home the point that the language of threat and force does not work with Iran, as it is committed to asserting its strength in international waters and providing security to its vessels.
Option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. The Limelight.
In Louisiana, United States, racial discrimination and fear are putting women's and babies' lives at risk. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The national broadcaster NBC News has covered this story and tells us more. A Louisiana hospital sent a mom home with prayers while she was miscarrying. Caitlin Joshua was given an ultrasound at Women's Hospital in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. They examined and monitored her. That's where, she says, the treatment ended. "And so I said, okay, so is this a miscarriage?" And the young lady, she said, "I can't really tell. I can't really tell you right now. I don't know." And I said, "Well, what do you mean? What do you know?" "You did the ultrasound," Joshua said. "I recall her saying, 'We're just sending you home with prayers. We're going to hope for the best.'" Meanwhile, a hospital spokesman in Baton Rouge said, "It's complex when diagnosis of early pregnancy loss is unclear. The standard of care is to wait." The next day, when bleeding and cramping became unbearable, Joshua sought help from a second hospital, the Baton Rouge General Hospital, where a doctor ordered another ultrasound. She said straight up, "This doesn't look like a baby at all. Are you sure you were ever pregnant? This just looks like a cyst." At both hospitals, Joshua said, medical care providers avoided directly responding to her questions about whether she was miscarrying. Joshua said her discharge papers only noted potential miscarriage. "I just have to believe, and I know, that it is just the vagueness of the abortion ban in the state that's caused so much fear around physicians doing their jobs," Caitlin Joshua said. A spokesman for Baton Rouge General Hospital said every patient is different. They said that since the abortion ban began, they have not changed the way they manage miscarriage or the options available to treat them. The hospital's discharge instructions left Joshua with one option, to take Tylenol and monitor for worsening symptoms. Since the new law was implemented, banning abortions in most cases, many physicians in Louisiana have been afraid to provide care typically used to treat miscarriage, a surgical procedure or a pill, because those same methods are used in abortions and can now be seen as illegal in Louisiana, potentially landing healthcare providers in prison. The U.S. national broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. Racial discrimination fear in Louisiana are putting women's and babies' lives at risk. A Louisiana hospital recently sent a mom home with prayers saying that while she was miscarrying, they could not do anything for her. Getting maternal care in Louisiana was already challenging before the law passed. The U.S. holds the sad distinction of having one of the highest rates of pregnancy-related deaths in the developed world, according to the World Health Organization, WHO. Women in the United States are 10 or more times likely to die from pregnancy-related causes than mothers in Poland, Spain, or Norway. Some of the worst statistics come out of the southern United States, where deep pockets of poverty, healthcare deserts, and racial discrimination have long put women and their babies' lives at greater risk. Where you live can heighten the risk. A third of Louisiana's 64 parishes are maternal healthcare deserts without a single obstetric provider, according to the March of Dimes. More than 51,000 women in Louisiana are left without easy access to healthcare. They are three times more likely to die of pregnancy-related causes, according to a Tulane University study published in Women's Health Issues. Doctors are scarce in Assumption Parish, Louisiana, a rural county of 21,000. Mums Teresa Dubois and Brittany Cavalier, both expecting their third child, need to travel 45 minutes to the nearest pediatrician and up to an hour 35 minutes to get to the closest hospital. Doctors, advocates, and mothers are leading the charge to improve maternal health care conditions across Louisiana. Dr. Rebecca G., an obstetrician, formerly State Secretary of Health and founder of Nest Health, a primary health service for families, has spent her career advocating for better maternal care in Louisiana. As Secretary of Health, Dr. Rebecca G. worked with the state board that reviews every maternal death in Louisiana. The board found that 80% of all pregnancy-related deaths in Louisiana were potentially preventable. 39 out of every 100,000 mothers die during or shortly after childbirth in the state of Louisiana, according to the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, the CDC.
As-salamu alaykum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghodde saratani Israel mukhalifim.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ideal University Student brings change in thinking and reality of the society and world. The following is part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution in a meeting with university students and representatives of student associations in the Imam Khomeini Hosseiniyah on April 18th, 2023.
I am not saying that you should get martyred. I pray to God that you don't get martyred. Of course, it's fine if you do when you are at an old age, but wait until you're 70 or 80 years old and then get martyred. We need you now while you're still young. Don't get martyred, but live like a martyr. Live like these people and take actions like them. The evil powers are very much against this group. My dear young people, follow the clear path with determination. Follow the clear path of the revolution, Islam, the country, the system, and the like with determination. Our country needs you. You need ideals. One of the few things that is truly needed on the path is idealism. You need hope. You need rationality. You need these. Idealism means looking at distant horizons. As I mentioned, movement is not possible without this. Idealism is the propelling force for movement. Hope is the fuel of this engine.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Without hope, this engine will not move. I will keep thinking and worrying about idealism if there is no hope. And rationality is the steering wheel for this engine. You must think rationally, act wisely, and move forward. As for universities, I have much to say about them. You also spoke about them, and what you said is correct. The problems you mentioned exist. What I want to say is that the lack of a truly comprehensive scientific plan is a great shortcoming in our universities today. We don't know what basis is used for the distribution of students in various scientific fields of study. These scientific courses of study should be in fields that are needed in the country. They must benefit the country. How many students do we need in a certain field? These matters should be considered, and work needs to be done on this. I'd like to ask the Honorable Minister of Science, he's probably among us here, to pursue this matter. It is one of the important tasks that you need to do.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong.
Think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
in the limelight.
The U.S. Republican Party would rather hold hungry American families hostage than tax the wealthy. The GOP, unable to destroy the social safety net through normal legislative processes, has turned to blackmail. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truthout noted recently, with negotiations on legislation to raise the debt ceiling reportedly stalled, 66 members of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, CPC, sent a letter to the president urging him to invoke 14th Amendment, one clause of which mandates the federal government to pay its bills as an end run around GOP obstructionism. Meanwhile, Senators Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, along with high-profile House members such as Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, have kept up a drumbeat of social media criticism, accusing the GOP of wanting to eviscerate social protections for the poor in order to satiate the tax-cutting demands of the super wealthy. At some point in the next 10 days, if Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen's forecasts are accurate, the U.S. stands to run out of money. Actually, to be accurate, there should be air quotes around that phrase, as in, the U.S. stands to run out of money. In reality, the U.S. has been operating in the red for decades, and from the George W. Bush presidency onward, it has made deficit spending a core part of the nation's social compact. Put simply, as a country that likes to spend a lot of cash on everything from missiles to other military equipment, from social security and food stamps to spying, but they don't like raising enough taxes to fully pay the bills. And given the place of immense power and privilege that the U.S. has in the world, to date, they have been remarkably lucky, with markets willing to lend the country trillions of dollars at spectacularly low interest rates. No other country on earth could get away so easily with such irresponsible spending and taxation policies. But that only works if those markets are super confident in the U.S. reliability, that when it owes interest payments on its debt, it will pay with no haggling, no tantrums, no effort to somehow cut a bargain. A loss of market confidence triggered by an entirely manufactured and avoidable political crisis around the Congress raising the debt ceiling is what Yellen really means when she talks about the country running out of cash. For the past several weeks, the White House and the congressional leadership have been involved in a prolonged back and forth mainly aimed at securing concessions from Biden that an unfeebled McCarthy can take to his hardline caucus, the most extreme members of which have a virtual veto power over anything he does. A month ago, the House passed a debt ceiling bill that included the promise of reducing across-the-board spending by 14% over a decade, given it exempted the military, Social Security, and Medicare from cuts. This would, if enacted, result in absolutely sweeping reductions to all other areas of federal spending, slashing education and environmental programs, putting a chainsaw to nutritional aid, eviscerating public health spending, and so on. This bill was nothing more than a political performance, and a bad performance at that, since neither the Democrat-controlled Senate nor the White House would seriously entertain such a measure. Now, Now, a month later, McCarthy's red line in his negotiations is supposedly imposing 20-hour-per-week work requirements on able-bodied recipients of the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP, commonly known as food stamps, as well as Medicaid and temporary assistance for needy families. Given that most people on SNAP who genuinely can work do already work, and given that many of the low-wage jobs available come with no health benefits and shockingly low pay, these requirements would likely further immiserate people without genuinely encouraging them to secure footholds that would take them up the country's economic ladder. In fact, the proposal is a recycled version of ideas that have circulated within the GOP for 30 years. Republicans proposed a $16.5 billion cut to SNAP in 1995 and a $40 billion cut 18 years later. Under this version of the proposal, able-bodied adults under the age of 56 would have their food stamps cut off after 3 months unless the recipient was working. Some of the most hardline GOP Congress members want that age cap increased to 65. They would be able to re-enroll again only after 3 years have elapsed, and then once more, they would be limited to 3 months of benefits every 3 years. The Congressional Budget Office have estimated that this would result in 275,000 people per month losing access to benefits that rely on. None of this would even begin to make a dent in the country's $31.4 trillion debt. Even the Foundation for Government Accountability, a conservative think tank that wholeheartedly embraces the workfare requirements, estimates it would only result in $149 billion in savings spread out over several years. That may sound like a lot, but in the grand scheme of things, it's financial chicken feet, less than 0.5% of the total amount of money the U.S. now owes to its creditors. For McCarthy to make this a red line in his negotiations over the debt ceiling is the worst kind of grandstanding. It has nothing to do with genuinely tackling the U.S. out-of-whack budget, and everything to do with blackmailing the Biden administration to impose destructive changes to the social safety net that the GOP has been unable to enact through normal legislative processes. If McCarthy succeeds in securing these work requirements and then gives the green light to his caucus to vote in favor of raising the debt ceiling, the United States fiscal imbalance will still continue APIS, and his caucus, which claims to be so fiscally responsible, will still have to vote for another debt ceiling increase months or years down the road. This is, after all, a problem largely created by the GOP's tax-slashing ideology, by major tax cuts under Ronald Reagan, George W. Bush, and Donald Trump that have disproportionately benefited the wealthy and cost the Treasury tens of trillions of dollars over the last 40 years. Unwilling to consider common sense tax reforms, Republicans are instead holding hungry families hostage to their ideology, and they are doing so in a particularly dangerous manner, threatening the possibility of a U.S. debt default unless they get their way over the coming days. If this game of brinksmanship goes wrong, as it all too easily might, given the hold that burn it all down extremists have over McCarthy's House leadership, the U.S. and, by extension, the global economy will suffer a huge and entirely needless hit. If the U.S. does end up defaulting, the decades in which the country has been able to borrow on the cheap to fund tax cuts for the affluent, bloated military budgets, and a safety net system for the elderly will grind to a sudden halt. None of this will solve the U.S. debt crisis. It will, with higher interest rates and even greater political chaos, simply make it exponentially worse.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
During the Tel Aviv regime's 11-day offensive in 2021, Israeli warplanes carried out one of the most horrendous massacres in one of the most densely populated neighborhoods in Gaza. The attacks destroyed three residential buildings, killing 44 civilians, including 18 children. Rescue teams took days to pull the bodies from under the rubble. Riyad Shkuntana and his 6-year-old daughter were among the survivors.
When the Israeli warplanes hit the building where we used to live in 2021, we were buried under the destroyed building. I spent 12 hours under the rubble before the rescue team could save me. I could hear the screams of my children calling me from under the debris. But my daughter Susie and I were the only survivors of my family. They told me that my wife and four of my children hadn't been able to make it when they found their bodies.
During the latest Israeli attack on the Gaza Strip, the family suffered again. Israeli jet fighters targeted the apartment adjacent to theirs.
I was playing with my cousins in the other room. Suddenly we heard a massive explosion. I directly rushed to my grandma. I was screaming and crying. The house was filled with smoke. I was frightened that the building might fall on us. We realized that the building next to ours was targeted. We escaped from our apartment, and so did all the other residents.
Susie hasn't been able to speak about the 2021 incident ever since it happened. She becomes speechless anytime she remembers what happened to her and her family back then. Talking to Press TV, her father asserted that there is no safe place in Gaza for his daughter, even though they demanded international protection after the 2021 incident.
It's all lies. Palestinian civilians are never protected from Israeli attacks. We don't trust international protection regulations. She had therapeutic sessions for 2 years, but my daughter is still suffering, and that memory haunts her anytime she hears a loud sound. She deserves to live in peace and security.
Susie Shkuntan.